Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, my own website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or at Banking Day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 10 in our series for 2024, and today's date is Friday, April the 5th. First, I'll be talking to Gartner VP of HR Advisory, Aaron McEwen, to talk about the future of work, people strategy and talent management strategies in the face of AI and ChatGPT. And I'll be talking to Indeed economist Callum Pickering about the latest unemployment figures. But first, let's talk to Aaron McEwen.
Aaron, lots been said about the future of work. What's the view at Gartner about it?
Well, it's a pretty big topic, so it's a little hard to know quite where to start. But I guess when we think about the future of work, the conversation over the last couple of years has really been dominated by the impact of hybrid work models and all of the changes that brings about. But I think the conversation more recently has really shifted to, generative AI and ChatGPT and what that type of technology is going to do to jobs and the workforce over time. Yeah, but there's a lot going on. There's new technologies, there's new work models emerging, and the world is increasingly becoming a very complex, volatile and connected place. So that has all sorts of implications for how we work and live.
There's a whole lot of speculation about automation and ChatGPT and everything like that jeopardizing jobs. Mm-hmm. And there's also speculation. I saw a projection from Goldman Sachs today saying that it's going to cost millions and millions of jobs. And I'm not entirely sure that's right, because my view is, yes, some jobs might go, but a lot of jobs will be created through automation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for many years, Gartner's perspective, and certainly my perspective on this, is that generally speaking, automation is a net creator of jobs. It's hard to envisage jobs that won't be touched and impacted by automation and the types of technologies I was talking about. But certainly, my view of this is that what automation and advanced technology tends to do to jobs is it pushes them up the value and complexity bar. So there probably will be a handful of jobs that might be eliminated altogether, but the more likely scenario is that these types of technologies impact all jobs and change them. So a more likely scenario is that parts of people's jobs will be carved away and automated. And generally speaking, that tends to be less complex, more repeatable work. But of course, with the advent of generative AI and the speed at which that seems to be evolving, would suggest that, areas that we thought previously might have been to a degree immune to automation, the more artistic and creative pursuits, it does look as though they will be heavily impacted. But again, I'll just repeat that, what tends to happen is it just pushes that work up the complexity bar. So whilst, artists might be in a bit of strife because it's very cheap and easy now to create artworks, I'm not sure that the average punter is going to be wanting to hang you know, an AI generated piece of art on their walls, because it, you know, there'll be millions and millions of them. So we'll be looking for increasingly more interesting work.
Well, this was very interesting, because when Canva came out, I knew a lot of graphic artists who said, well, this is the end of our work, but they're still finding work. And the issue with Canva is it's very much the same. It produces very much the same sort of work, and I'm not sure people would invest in that. And I found the same with ChatGPT. It produces word-perfect words, but it's very bland and it's mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs a human touch. So I would say that even with ChatGPT, it needs human vetting. Absolutely. People can still be involved. People can still have work, although at another end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be applied to a lot of automation as well. You might have fewer tellers in banks, but banks are still going to be putting on more people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, tellers is a good example of how this is likely to play out. But one of my favorite examples is the insurance industry. So let's say you're a customer service rep, you know, you're in an inbound call center working for an insurance company. You know, 5 years ago, the majority of calls you would have taken would have been related to change of address or updating my policy. Of course, most of that work can now be handled through automated processes, you know, chatbots, algorithms, etc. But, you know, we do know that the impacts of climate change are getting more intense and more frequent. So presumably the claims will also rise, but so too will the complexity of those claims. And so even though you might not be fielding a bunch of calls about updating your policy, the most likely call that they'll take in the future is going to be, I've just lost my house to a natural disaster, and I may have even lost members of my family or beloved pets. So the requirement on the human being that fields that call is a higher order of cognitive complexity, but probably more importantly, a higher order of emotional complexity. So the work just gets harder and more complex. It doesn't necessarily go away.
And the work might become more complex, but it does need a human touch.
That's exactly right. And you know, at the moment, those, you know, language-based models of AI are very good at wordsmithing, but I'm not sure that they're great yet at understanding the emotional complexity of humans and what the most appropriate response is. Now, of course, I could say that neither are humans. So, you know, we've got a bit of an issue with management and leadership at the moment, lacking those complex abilities to manage complex human emotions, which is becoming an increasingly important part of their role.
That said, I mean, there's a whole lot of career planning issues there,
mm-hmm.
isn't there?
Potentially. I mean, it's kind of interesting at the moment. What most organizations try to do around this issue is that they try to predict the skills required of the future. But what our research shows is that a predictive model is actually less effective than a reactive model, which is really interesting in and of itself, right? So the more effective model is to develop what we call a skill sensing network. So this is a network of individuals and institutions that are able to provide input on how skills are changing. So if you're an organization, you might have relationships with think tanks and universities to get a sense of what's coming down the pipeline. And obviously that's a role that Gartner plays for many organizations. But one of your best sources of understanding how the skills in a particular job or profession are changing are the people that do that job. And one of the things we tend to do is not talk to those people enough about what they think is required in the future. So yes, I think, you know, career management is going to become a really important part of human resources and talent management in the future. But, you know, human beings themselves are pretty good at understanding how their work is changing. And that's probably one of the most exciting parts about this AI revolution that's coming, is that most employees have a very keen understanding of the friction points in their work. And those friction points are often really simple things. So one of the things we know that AI is going to do is it's going to dramatically reduce the cost of software development. And potentially placed that in the hands of everyday employees, what we call citizen developers. So one of the more exciting elements of the future is the degree and speed at which citizen developers will tackle the most annoyingly minute components of people's work and hopefully eradicate or at least improve those.
That's quite extraordinary. So it'll be democratized, if you like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Software development as a result of AI is very likely to be democratized. Rather than needing to understand coding, what you need to do is understand how to work with a generative AI application, put the right inputs in so that you get the best responses from it.
So you won't necessarily have to be trained in coding.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So you can imagine sitting there doing your job and going, oh, the most annoying part of my job is X. And you jump onto your favorite AI application and you say, what's the most effective and efficient way to remove this friction point? And so, you know, in essence, employees might start to essentially change their own jobs, which, by the way, opens up another incredible opportunity that might come out of this, which is genuine job crafting, where people craft their jobs to their specific set of, you know, strengths and skill sets and cognitive preferences, social preferences. Yeah, that's an exciting future.
And that actually, if you like, democratizes the workplace.
I would hope so. Yeah. Although I think there'll be a lot of pushback to that democratization from those in power.
Well, that'll be fascinating to watch. Absolutely fascinating. Aaron, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure.
And now let's talk to Indeed economist Callum Pickering.
Well, Callum, what's your view about the latest unemployment figures?
Well, it came as a little bit of a surprise, much lower than anticipated, with the unemployment rate down to 3.7%. It was previously 4.1%. And the consensus view was that we were going to be drifting a little bit higher in the near term. And so it certainly bucked that trend. The overall employment figure up 116,500 people is obviously an outstanding result for a single month. But I think when we interpret that data, we need to be mindful that the employment figures have been very volatile in recent months. They've been up and down and all about. And so if you sort of take a step back and look at the bigger picture, maybe over, say, the past 4 months, you get a sense that the job market is still really quite good. But the February figure is maybe somewhat misleading in the sense that the gain is much larger than we have been seeing for a number of months.
Is that a rise in full-time employment?
Certainly in February it was. Very strong full-time employment growth. But again, if we take a step back and we look at what's happened over the past 12 months, we can see that most of the job gains have been in part-time employment. Full-time employment gains only account for around one-third of the total, which is very low, because normally, if you look at the overall job market, around 70% of overall employment is full-time. So the fact that it's only accounted for around one-third of employment growth over the past year is obviously a relatively weaker result from a full-time perspective. So the Australian jobs market is creating a lot of jobs. I mean, that is undeniable, but it may not be creating the same quality jobs that it was earlier in the pandemic recovery, which is reflected in part-time and casual accounting for a much larger share.
Yes, but and they would be mainly jobs in, say, cafes and restaurants and retail would be part-time.
Certainly those roles are part-time, but we do see part-time roles across the economy. I mean, if we look at the fastest growing industry over the past 3 or 4 years, it's been healthcare and social assistance. That's an industry that has tons of part-time workers, you know, aged care workers, you know, working part-time or casual across different aged care homes, things like that. Many nurses work part-time or on a casual basis as well. So while retail and accommodation and food services and things like that do have a very large share of part-time workers, it pops up maybe where you wouldn't anticipate as well.
So, but full-time work would create high quality employment, that'd be right?
Well, we would typically view full-time employment as being higher quality jobs, certainly more secure, better paid. So we always need to factor in the share of full-time versus part-time when we interpret what's happening with overall employment growth. Because if employment jumps by 400,000 people in a 12-month period, and all of those people are full-time, that's going to have a much bigger economic impact than, say, 400,000 people joining the workforce, but all of them are part-time. So we just need to be sort of mindful of that when we interpret the figures.
What about underutilization?
Yeah, so consistent with the unemployment rate falling quite significantly in February, we saw the same for underutilization. Now, the underutilization rate, of course, is the sum of the unemployment rate and the underemployment rate. It dropped to 10.3% in the month of February, down from 10.8% in January. Now, 10.3% At face value seems like a really big number, but it's actually really quite low by historical standards, and it's well below where we were before the pandemic began. So it once again highlights just how tight the Australian labour market continues to be, with, you know, recruitment still quite challenging across the nation and skill shortages quite common as well.
But that 10.3% underutilisation rate would also reflect a large number of part-time workers wanting to move full-time.
Yeah, that's right. Like I said, it is the sum of the unemployment rate plus the underemployment rate. So if you've got an unemployment rate of 3.7% and the underutilisation rate is 10.3%, then that gap is made up by people who are underemployed, who are maybe working part-time hours, maybe 15, 20 hours a week, but they'd like something closer to a full-time schedule. So absolutely, you know, that part does reflect part-time workers who would love to have more work, which obviously makes sense in the current economic environment with significant cost of living pressures.
What does that mean for wages?
Well, wage growth has obviously been very strong over the past 12 months. And the fact that the labour market remains very tight, again, with that 3.7% unemployment rate, 10.3% underutilisation rate, suggests that wage growth should remain quite strong, at least in the first half of this year. So we're going to continue to see wage growth in the high 3% range, maybe low 4% range, again, at least for the first half of the year. So wage pressures are still going to be quite strong across the nation.
Although that'd be less so because a large part of that increase is in part-time employment.
Well, it depends on what measure of wages you're looking at. The standard measure that we tend to focus on and the Reserve Bank likes to focus on is what we call the wage price index. Now, that is an index which controls for composition of the workforce. And so if all the jobs are part-time that are being created, that doesn't actually affect that measure. There are other measures of wages, such as average hourly earnings or average weekly earnings, that are absolutely impacted by, you know, a large share of employment gains being part-time. So measures of compensation for employees that would feature in, say, the national accounts absolutely would be impacted by the types of jobs that are being created. So what we could see is stronger growth in the wage price index versus other measures of wages because of that compositional discrepancy.
Well, these figures are really hard to interpret. What does that mean for the Reserve Bank looking at these numbers?
Well, the Reserve Bank will probably, that they will recognise that the data has been very volatile in the past few months. And they'll try to look through that volatility by, again, taking a step back and looking at, say, the past 3 months or the past 6 months or the past 12 months to get a better sense of what's happening in the labour market. But the fact that the labour market continues to be so tight and continues to be really resilient means that the Reserve Bank doesn't really have to worry about jobs market at the moment. So rather than being concerned around a recession or a significant outbreak in unemployment, they can focus purely on inflation. And so they can really just focus more on the inflation figures than the labour market figures, which I think would ultimately make them happy, because it doesn't mean that they're not going to have to sort of compromise their commitment to get inflation down because, say, the economy deteriorates. Now, the overall flow of data that we have seen outside of the labour market has been relatively weak. Inflation does appear to be headed in the right direction. So I don't really see much of an argument for hiking rates again this year. And certainly there is a lot of conversation at the moment around cutting rates, which I think you can make a compelling argument around that. But I think the fact that the jobs market is proving to be so resilient and so strong perhaps makes that likelihood of a rate cut this year a little bit lower than it was before the latest labour market figures came out.
I mean, in her first press conference, Michelle Bullock said the problem with inflation in Australia has got a 4 in front of it. And so it has to come down quite substantially. Now, to get to 2 to 3%, I don't think they'd wait for that long. But to get it down to, say, just above 3%, that's going to take some time.
It's certainly a possibility. I mean, I think there is I wouldn't necessarily say it's a strong possibility, but I do think there is a possibility that we get inflation back within that 2 to 3% target this year at some point. Now, the key question is whether that's sustainable. You know, you can get back to it, but are you going to stay there? And I think that's sort of the thing that the RBA is going to be grappling with going forward, because there is a bit of a disconnect between productivity growth and wage growth. And unless that disconnect sort of corrects itself, it's going to be really difficult to achieve inflation of 2 to 3% on a sustainable basis.
But with the growth of employment, the RBA would be hoping there'd be some correction in productivity levels, surely.
Well, that's certainly what they're forecasting. They anticipate that over the next couple of years, productivity growth is going to return to its long-run trend, which it's been nowhere near for the last couple of years because of COVID disruptions and all sorts of things that are going on. Now, that's a really strong assumption that is controlling sort of the RBA's view of the overall economic outlook as well as monetary policy. If productivity doesn't come back anywhere near as strong as the RBA expects, then inflation's going to run higher than they anticipate. It's not going to come down to target as quickly as they anticipate. So I think that's one of the big risks around the economic outlook. And it's certainly one of the things they're going to be watching the closest over the next 12 months, because they really need to see productivity come up or wage growth come down in order for that wage and productivity dynamic to begin to make.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Sense.
But wage growth has been running at about 4%. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's right. Very, very high by historical standards. By comparison, labor productivity has actually declined over the past year. In an ideal world, we probably want labor productivity increasing by 1-1.5%, which would absorb some of that wage growth, which means that it's not going to be passed on into higher inflation. We're not currently seeing that. But the Reserve Bank anticipates that productivity is going to return to more normal levels over the next 12 months, over the next 2 years. But yeah, that's going to be a big problem.
And so the arithmetic of that would be you'd have to have productivity at around 2% to accommodate wage growth of about 4%. Would that be right?
You could go a little bit lower, down to 1.5%. That would be okay. But certainly you want to see pretty robust productivity growth to absorb wage growth of that nature. I think it is likely that the wage growth may soften just a little bit, particularly as those cost of living adjustments, sort of the impact of those diminish. You know, if inflation is going to run at 3.5%, maybe 3% at some point this year, I don't think we're going to see those big 5% increases in the minimum wage that we have been seeing in recent years. So it's a good chance that wage growth is going to come down, which is going to help a little bit, but we need productivity to also help.
Well, Callum, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So what's happening in the news? Well, in an extraordinary development in the Lean versus Ten defamation case, a former producer of Seven's Spotlight program besmirched Bruce Lehrman's credibility by alleging he had received perks totaling tens of thousands of dollars, including a $361 stake and reimbursement for the cost of sex workers and illicit drugs before he signed an exclusive interview deal with the network. Network 10 succeeded on Tuesday night in an urgent application to call fresh evidence about Lehrman's dealings with Seven as part of its defence of the former federal Liberal staffer's multi-million-dollar defamation case over an interview with Brittany Higgins aired on the project on February 15, 2021. Federal Court Justice Michael Lee postponed his judgment in the defamation case, which was slated to be delivered at 10:15 a.m. on Thursday, to hear evidence on Thursday afternoon from former Spotlight producer Taylor Auerbach, who will be called by 10. 10's barrister, Dr. Matt Collins KC, told the court on Tuesday evening that Auerbach would allege Lehrman gave 7 confidential information from his aborted ACT Supreme Court criminal trial for Higgins' sexual assault, including more than 2,300 pages of private text messages between Higgins and her ex-boyfriend, Ben Dillaway. Lehrman has previously told the court he did not give documents to 7. Collins alleged evidence before the judge would suggest 17 of the 2,321 pages of Higgins and Dillaway's texts were ultimately tendered in the criminal trial, and that if Lehrman had leaked them to Seven, he had acted in breach of an implied obligation not to use material obtained during the criminal trial process for collateral purpose. Asked in court last year if he'd given any documents that Seven has contemplated under the exclusive interview deal signed in April last year, Lehrman said, "No, I just gave an interview." Ten is seeking to argue that Auerbach's evidence, if accepted, raises doubts about Lehrman's credibility. Auerbach says in two affidavits that Lehrman provided him with Higgins and Dillaway's text messages on or about the 18th of December 2022 in Bridport, Tasmania, during a golf trip paid by Seven. He claims a round of golf cost $401.83. An affidavit shows Auerbach was employed by Seven as senior producer on Spotlight for 2 years until August last year, after which he made claim against Seven for psychological injury, which I settle on confidential terms. Auerbach's claims, which have yet to be tested in court and are set out in three affidavits filed in the proceedings, include allegations that a raft of purchases were incurred by me and or Seven for the benefit of Lehrman. Among the receipts annexed to his affidavits is a $504 meal at the Chop House restaurant in Sydney in January 2023, including a 361 tomahawk steak weighing 1.9 kilograms. Auerbach alleges in one of his three affidavits that Seven paid for a taxi for Lehrman from Franca restaurants in Potts Point to Meriton, Sydney on January the 5th last year, and that money Lehrman paid for illicit drugs and prostitutes that evening at the Meriton and the following evening at a brothel at Surrey Hills were reimbursed to him by Seven. He claims this was done through per diems via invoice emailed to Spotlight's unit manager after Lehrman left Sydney in early January. "I no longer have a copy of this invoice," he says in one affidavit. Auerbach also claims that receipts for Sensei Thai massage, which he booked for Lehrman in Elizabeth Bay months earlier, on November 26, 2022, totaled approximately $10,315. Text messages next to Auerbach's affidavit suggest he subsequently texted an unknown party connected to the massage transactions and said, "Can you refund credit card and I give you cash?" Samantha Maiden, political reporter at newscorp.com.au, had previously reported that two Thai masseuses were booked, one for Lehrman and another for a Seven employee, later reported to be Auerbach, in the early hours of Saturday, November 26, 2022. The total amount paid in one night for Mr. Lehrman and the Seven staffer appears on the Spotlight credit card as $2,940 in multiple transactions of $1,000, Maiden's report said. And Paula Hitchcock says she regularly attended the billionaire Pratt's family weekly Shabbat at the invitation of her biological father, Richard Pratt, and his wife, Jean. She was also offered a bedroom in their Melbourne home and joined their family holidays. New details of the family connections have been made by the deceased Fizzy magnate's love child in a latest claim. At stake is one of Australia's biggest family fortunes. The 27-year-old is trying to prove she is legally entitled to the same slice of the Pratt family trust as her high-profile half-siblings, Anthony Pratt, Heloise Weislitz and Fiona Geminder. Richard Pratt, who was one of Australia's richest men, lived an extraordinary double life. He was married to Jean, but also had high-profile affairs. The man, who emigrated from Poland to Australia in 1938 and went from acting to taking over the family business, died in 2009, but left his wife and children much more than his wealth. The late Pratt made his fortune spearheading one of his father's businesses that manufactured cardboard boxes, Fizzy, and amassed a fortune now worth $27 billion. Paula Hitchcock is now asking the New South Wales Supreme Court to declare her a discretionary object of the Pratt Family Holdings Trust, arguing a deed of exclusion, which fairly cut her out as a child according to the siblings, should be voided. Amid a two-year court stoush, Ms. Hitchcock is fighting to put an amended statement of claim on the court's record that lists several examples, she says, demonstrate that she was acknowledged as part of the Pratt family at all times since her birth. Ms. Hitchcock was initially left a mansion in the Sydney Harbourside suburb of Watson's Bay and a property in rural New South Wales in Pratt's will. She also stood to collect $23 million in private shares upon her 21st birthday. After Pratt died in 2009, Ms. Hitchcock's mother contested his will, leaving the Hitchcocks with a settlement that included shares and property. Lawyers for the Pratt siblings are arguing Ms. Hitchcock's amended statement of claims should not be accepted, and at a hearing in February said it was seriously defective. It came after pleadings had been filed multiple times, and New South Wales Supreme Court Judge Meek noted that the case had been ongoing for 22 months, which was a fairly long time. And speaking of dynasties, a third-generation member of the billionaire Beeson family has issued a rallying call to wealthy Australians to be more thoughtful about where they make investments. investments, arguing they have a responsibility to help create the world they want to see. If your wealth is not meaningful to you, you've missed a massive opportunity, said Adam Milgram, grandson of the late retail fashion billionaire Mark and Eva Beeson. Those of us who are lucky to have wealth and have more than what we need have a responsibility to make our investments meaningful for society. I would love to see that all investors are being thoughtful with where their money is going, instead of thinking of investing as an activity that is just there to generate returns, to really think about investing as a tool that they can use to create the world that they want to see. If you think about it from a gardening analogy, the plants you water are ones that are going to grow. Mr. Milgram's great-uncle is property magnate John Gandel, co-owner of Melbourne's Chadstone Shopping Centre, one of the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere. His mother is Naomi Milgram, who controls retail brands Suzanne, Sports Girl and Suzanne Grey, while his aunt is Reserve Bank of Australia Director Carol Schwartz. Mr. Milgram's uncle, Alan Schwartz, late last year argued that there was still too big a divide in the investment strategies of a nation's family offices, structures established by rich families to manage wealth between the commercial and philanthropic. He argued that still too few connected their philanthropy to commercial, profit-making opportunities. The first and second generation of the Beeson and Gandel families have built a strong tradition of giving. The Beeson Family Foundation, run by Mr. Milgram's auntie, Debbie Dedon, was established more than three decades ago to build upon the philanthropic tradition started by Mark and Eva Beeson. And the Australian economy is in the middle of a perfect storm, with insolvencies rising to an almost decade high last month, as businesses struggle with crushing debt and a shortage of cash. Australian Securities and Investments Commission figures show there have been 2,566 insolvency appointments so far this calendar year to March 31, compared with 1,881 during the same period in 2023. Revive Financial Head of Business Restructuring and Insolvency, Jarvis Archer, said insolvencies were tracking about 36% higher in the 2024 financial year, compared with 2022-23. They are averaging about 826 a month, up from 660 per month last year. Mr. Archer said preliminary numbers indicated more than 1,040 companies entered external administration in March, which was the highest number since September 2015. He said for the first time, small business restructuring appointments had exceeded voluntary administration and court liquidation appointments. Construction continued to be the biggest casualty of the current insolvency wave, with a stream of major national companies calling in administrators. Building giant St. Hilliers, which does work for the Department of Defence, went into voluntary administration in February, leaving 21 jobs in limbo and initially owing $13 million, while national fit-out and refurbishment business Rourke Projects collapsed, owing about $30 million. Last week, Queensland civil construction specialist All Roads was placed in liquidation, leaving a string of roads and defence projects with an uncertain future. Retailers have also been hit. 93-year-old vacuum cleaner seller Godfrey's sought a buyer after being forced into voluntary administration. Mr. Archer said the impact of the pandemic and challenging trading conditions caused many businesses to stop paying their taxes. And national home values set a record high for a fifth consecutive month in March, as a resilient economy and the swelling population pointed to further increases to come. The home value index compiled by data group CoreLogic showed prices rose 0.6% last month, matching February's increase. Median home prices were $772,730, rebounding just over one-tenth since its recent nadir in January 2023. A separate index run by PropTrack produced similar results. National home prices were 0.34% higher in March, to be up 6.79% from a year earlier, also a fresh peak. And one of Australia's largest energy utilities says clean hydrogen has the potential to become a viable fuel capable of replacing natural gas in power plants within a decade, eliminating the need to consider building expensive nuclear generators. The federal opposition is fighting the Albanese government over its ambitious renewable energy rollout targets and is pitching nuclear as the nation's essential future source of power to compensate for coal exiting the grid. Critics of the coalition's push, however, say onerous capital costs and lengthy construction timelines make nuclear energy an impractical solution for Australia's needs. Engie Australia, the country's third largest electricity and gas supplier, believes nuclear energy is unnecessary and does not include the technology in its long-term planning. Instead, says Energy Australia Chief Executive Mark Collette, green hydrogen could be scaled up to become a commercially available power source faster than it could take Australia to establish a nuclear industry. Green hydrogen, the name for hydrogen made using renewable energy, burns cleanly, meaning it could provide the same emissions-free backup for the grid during times of low wind and solar generation as nuclear. Green hydrogen is considered a promising future fuel due to its potential to displace gas and help decarbonize processes that cannot be simply electrified. However, it remains prohibitively expensive to make and is not yet viable at scale, with most of today's hydrogen still made using fossil fuels. Despite its advantages, green hydrogen is not yet part of our energy mix due to difficulties that research, government policies and private investment have to overcome. And one of Australia's top green energy superpower advocates said it's unclear whether the nation has a comparative advantage in the solar panel industry the Albanese government is propping up with $1 billion of support, including in regions facing the likely loss of thousands of coal-fired power station workers, some earning up to $170,000. Economist Rod Sim said while there was no doubt the country would need a hell of a lot of panels to seize the opportunities created by abundant renewable solar energy, its ability to produce them economically and in a way that produces high-paying jobs was another matter. There are reasons to support an industry that has a clear future with a comparative advantage, he said. What I don't know one way or the other is whether solar panels do. The warning, which echoes the view of Labor-appointed Productivity Commission head Daniel Wood, comes as government modelling revealed between 50% and 80% of workers at coal-fired power stations may fail to find new jobs when fossil fuel generation collapses in the next decade or so. As the Albanese government finalises this year's annual budget, potentially the last ahead of the next election, the focus is increasingly on how to manage the challenge of decarbonising the economy while supporting workers and communities that will bear much of the costs. At the same time, they're preparing a Biden administration-style support package to spur industries that could fill the void left by the fossil fuel industry. Professor Sims, a former competition regulator who now champions domestic expansion in green energy, steel and fertiliser production funded via taxes on oil, gas and coal exporters, said Australia has a comparable advantage because it competes in some of the basic ingredients that go into making panels, including green iron and silicon. What I don't know is whether having a comparative advantage in silicon translates into making solar panels. I just don't know. But we'll need a lot of them. He said getting such investments wrong would mean putting people into jobs that will be low paying because they're not natural industries to be involved in for Australia. Labor tabled legislation last week to establish the Net Zero Economy Authority, one of Mr. Albanese's key pre-election promises to workers exposed by the accelerating closure of coal-fired power stations. A government impact analysis of the new agency's legislation outlines the costs and benefits of three broad policy options when managing fallout from the closure of 10 of 19 remaining coal-fired coal power stations between now and the end of 2035, with another 7 to follow by the mid-2050s. The options include retaining the status quo, in which workers rely on existing supports with no further government involvement, a version in which unions and employers voluntarily implement pool redeployment of workers between remaining coal-fired power stations, and the government's favoured, more explicitly interventionist framework that will force companies to support workers. And China's removal of punishing tariffs on Australian wine exports will be celebrated with the popping of corks over the Easter weekend, but rebuilding the $1.1 billion trade will take time, said Assistant Trade Minister Tim Ayres. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce announced late on Thursday it was no longer necessary to impose sanctions on Australian wine imports. They were imposed by Beijing at the height of diplomatic tensions in 2020. The decision removes one of the last major sanctions on $20 billion worth of Australian exports, with restrictions remaining on lobster and beef. Mr. Ayres said China's decision was a result of the really hard and determined work put in by his government. It is a very welcome development that comes on the back of $20 billion worth of impediments to Australian exporters. Wine was the biggest final part of that piece, he told Sky News. Asked when the Chinese market would recover to its $1.1 billion peak, Senator Ayres said it was going to take time. And British Formula One racing team McLaren has teamed up with the Great Barrier Reef Foundation to help accelerate the restoration of coral on one of Australia's biggest tourism draw cards. In an unlikely pairing, the motorsports teams, whose drivers include Australian young gun Oscar Piastri, competed at the Melbourne Grand Prix last weekend, sent two engineers to North Queensland late last year to help the non-for-profit organisation work out how to scale up coral spawning production on the reef. The Great Barrier Reef is the epicentre of climate change. McLaren Chief Executive Zach Brown said the McLaren racing staff were giving an engineer's perspective the Great Barrier Reef Foundation's coral spawning program by looking for ways to improve the production process. McLaren has a number of technology partnerships with major companies, including Google, and helped manufacture ventilators for the UK government during the pandemic. Scientists can grow a few hundred thousand corals a year in an aquarium, focusing on more climate-resilient varieties to help withstand warmer ocean temperatures at a price of $7 to $10 per coral. The coral is then inserted into ceramic devices, which looks like a star, with each branch about 6 centimetres long, and then deposited onto the reef. With the assistance of McLaren engineers, who helped identify bottlenecks and streamline the process, the Great Barrier Reef Foundation is hoping to reduce the cost for production to less than $1 per coral. This would allow them to scale up an interim target of 2 million coral a year by 2025, and ultimately 200 million coral a year by 2030. The Great Barrier Reef Foundation is hoping to automate the process of putting coral on tabs, like chocolate blocks, in the aquarium, and for deployment onto the reef, both of which have so far been done manually. McLaren, like Formula One, is also grappling with its own carbon footprint, conscious of the sport, which travels with large entourages to 24 races around the world each year, also has a responsibility to do something on climate change. Formula One has already committed to burning carbon-neutral fuels within 2 years. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Paul Bevan, the CEO of Melbourne-based agri-food startup Magic Valley, with its development of cultivated pork. And I'll be talking to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver about Australia's latest inflation figures. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, you can catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongettler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week, and looking forward to bringing Talking Business next week.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.